This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of Letters from Kayfabe. I'm here with Alan. How are you doing, Alan?
How are you, Parv? I'm absolutely fantastic. I'm hyped, I'm ready, I'm pumped, and I'm ready to go to answer some more listeners' questions on today's show.
Yes, and why don't we throw out our Twitter handles and things right at the top here so people know how to get hold of us.
Okay, well, to get hold of me, if you want to send me questions or comments, feedback, whatever, the best way to get me is on Twitter. So my username is Alan_Cheapshot. That's Alan_Cheapshot. And how do we get hold of you, Parv?
I'm at Jerry Von K. And we've already, you know, people have been sending us lots of questions, and we've got, you know, the mailbag has got quite a backlog at this point, doesn't it, Alan?
Yeah, it does. It's the sack is getting fuller and fuller. But keep sending them in, and we'll be sure to use them down the line on future shows, because there's a lot of good questions coming in that I'm quite looking forward to answering for the listeners.
Well, Alan, why don't you have a little dip into your sack and see what you can pull out?
We'll be back with the mailbag. Oh, and no doubt the mailbag has just arrived.
Well, if a postman delivered like that in England, I'd fire him immediately.
Right, let's see what's in my sack this episode. So, we've got a letter here. Dear Alan and Parv, what did you make of the WWF acknowledging Smoky Mountain Wrestling in 1993? And that's sent in from Bradley D'Amato in Bensalem, Pennsylvania. So, Bradley, that blew my mind, basically. To set the scene, WWF had never acknowledged anyone else in the world in wrestling since 1982. Parv, do you know who they would have mentioned in 1982?
I suspect it would have been Ric Flair.
In 82. So it was 9 years. So this was 93.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, 84, sorry, my mouth, God. In 84, that was 9 years, I do apologise. So, in 84, who was the last promotion, you think, that they mentioned or acknowledged?
Ooh, that's a really good question. Well, if it wasn't the NWA, who was it?
It was New Japan, because they still had the working agreement, didn't they?
Of course. And in fact, that's something that we will have to return to on a different show, which is the lineage of the WWF presidents, a little hobby topic of mine, because, of course, the New Japan guy was the president. Up until Jack Tunney came in.
So. Yes, that's right. And, you know, there's some interesting things there that the WWF, obviously, at that time, co-promote with New Japan. They did co-promote after that, obviously, with the likes of SWS, Tenryu's group, and also War. Those two groups there over in Japan. So they have worked with other groups and USWA, but the first one to be acknowledged was Smoky Mountain Wrestling on TV. So what basically happened was, on an episode of Raw, this was summer of 1993, Bobby Heenan came out, and he basically announces Jim Cornette to the live audience and to the TV audience. He's literally Heenan. It's quite funny. He's tripping over himself with glee. And he does an amazing job putting Cornette over when he brings him out. There was a huge pop from a group of heel fans in the actual crowd, which is noticeable on TV. They both hug each other like the greatest friends. And then we have a great Cornette promo. He just cuts this awesome promo telling you who he is, what he's doing here. And the excitement from Bobby Heenan is great. And the one thing I kind of took from this, I know Bobby Heenan wasn't a manager at this point, but for me, Bobby Heenan may or may not know he was on his way out at the time, you know, because his time left in WWF was not long. But maybe this was a passing of the torch, Parv, to, you know, Jim Cornette, who was kind of the future manager that he saw that had done his trade in Memphis in NWA, and now he's in the big leagues.
Well, I mean, first of all, for a hardcore wrestling fan, that's like, I don't know, the Joker meeting Lex Luthor or something for the first time. It's like an incredible meeting of two complete supervillains of the wrestling world. And I mean, I don't know if you want to talk about best managers ever. You know, it's not long before Heenan and Cornette's names are going to come up.
They're definitely in a conversation, that's for sure. They were top-tier managers, both of them, and great personalities, both in their own right. What I liked about this is it was a great visual. you know, for a fan, I mean, myself in 1993, I'd been watching WWF for just over 2 years at this point, and I'd heard of Smoky Mountain Wrestling. Here in the UK, obviously, it's a lot harder to get kind of niche news. WWF Magazine was on sale, but we did get Pro Wrestling Illustrated, we did get Inside Wrestling.
And I was also reading PWI by this point in 93.
Yeah, so it was mentioned, and it was touched upon as well in the British magazine Superstars of Wrestling. Smoky Mountain was mentioned there as well in some of the latter parts of the magazine. So it was something I was aware of, and I was very conscious that I felt it was weird as a fan that WWF didn't mention anyone else. At first, I didn't understand the kind of the dynamics of wrestling and the, how political it can be and how you don't want to put over, you know, another promotion. So when they mentioned it, it blew my mind. I mean, what was your take at the time on this, Parv?
Well, can I ask you a very quick question? Did you know at that point that Jim Cornette was associated with, you know, as you know, in real life as somebody who ran that promotion, and that Vince McMahon was the owner of the WWF? Because me, in 1993... even though I read PWI, maybe I didn't do it in the detail to notice that, you know, Vince was listed as the owner. To me, he was just still the commentator on TV. So I had no, like, absolutely zero knowledge of the backstage stuff at that point in my fandom. And for me, I didn't really understand what Smoky Mountain Wrestling was. I realized that they were, you know, a smaller regional promotion. But my memories of it were, who are these guys and why are they, like, I felt that they were bringing down the product. You know, this was towards the tail end of the height of my fandom, I would say. And to me, I actually, as I was just telling you off air, Alan, slightly resented the fact that these, you know, lesser wrestlers were now taking a place on the card on these WWF shows.
I can see where you're coming from there, obviously, as fresh eyes to Smoky Mountain and seeing kind of the Jim Cornette come out and with the southern accent. And I think that's a very important thing to note for me anyway. In 1993, WWF, we had a few southern accents coming onto the TV product. We had Jim Ross from WrestleMania 9. And then, you know, a few months later, we had James E. Cornette. And to me, watching WWF as a kid, there was no accents as such. It was just an American accent. No one really stood out with a specific accent who was American. Obviously, there was different people from around the world or people who played accents or played characters with accents, but your standard American wrestler, they all seem to have a similar accent, to me anyway. And then these guys came in, and I'm going to sound like Kevin Dunn here. Bear in mind, at the time, in 93, I was, you know, 11, 12, so to me at the time, I thought it brought the product down a bit, a little bit hokey. Now, obviously, I don't think that at all. It's just because I wasn't familiar with a southern accent as such on my wrestling product.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I didn't mind Jim Ross as much because I used to watch WCW Worldwide on ITV. And even though I did definitely see WWF as number one and WCW as number two, I was so into WCW in 1992 with the Dangerous Alliance. And, you know, they had Jesse Ventura there. And, you know, that they'd moved to that studio in the Saturday night. So I kind of, in my mind, WCW were clearly a little bit smaller, but they were still quite, you know, still the big leagues in my mind, you know. Whereas when these guys were coming in, you know, Jimmy Del Rey and, you know, Pritchard and some of these figures who were showing up on WWF cards, I really was just... I just thought they were jobbers, Alan. I'll be honest. I just thought, like, why are these guys, you know, why are they having such long matches? And where are the, you know, and it sounds pathetic. It sounds ridiculous now to us as hardcore fans now. But at that time, I was really like, why aren't the Steiner brothers just coming and destroying these guys, you know?
But that's part of the charm, though, in a way. If you think about it now, you could generate quite a bit of heat off the back of just looking like that and being different. I mean, different is good. I mean, in 1993 landscape as well, this wouldn't have happened 2 years ago. you know, bringing guys in on TV, you know, to give them a bit of a push with the bodies that they had. I mean, no pun intended, but especially Jimmy Del Rey, they weren't going to ever be used in a kind of positive manner. But 1993, obviously, the landscape had changed. So at the time, yeah, it blew my mind just mentioning it on TV. I just couldn't believe it. It was like they're admitting there's more to the world of wrestling than WWF. And it was just amazing, I thought. And the interesting thing, that it was Bruce Pritchard was the one who brokered the deal between Jim and Vince. It was sold basically to Jim that himself and the bodies, they'd come in, only work TV and pay-per-views, and Smoky Mountain would get put over on WWF TV. So that was basically right. The initial arrangement. So Smoky Mountain was obviously hoping to get a rub off this for their own kind of promotional tours that they're doing in Kentucky and Tennessee and, you know, those areas of the country. But 3 hours before Cornette came out at TV, Vince and Jim Ross told him they had plans for him to be Yoko's manager.
Yeah, I was going to ask about this.
Yeah, so they, when they wanted Cornette from the beginning, straight away, but they neglected to tell him until he was already there. So I don't know if that was a ploy or a tactic at all. So when they got him there, we want you, and, you know, as they say, the rest is history.
Because Cornette ended up doing quite a lot, didn't he, behind the scenes at the WWF and working as a commentator and... You know, he was associated with them for some time, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, he was in the inner circle. I mean, there's many times he's told stories that he's been at Vince's house, you know, 2-3 in the morning in the kind of war room or where Vince sits, you know, planning things. Because obviously Vince doesn't sleep. I think he does 23-hour working days. So anyone else that can't do that is seen as weak. So you had poor Jim Cornette and Pat Patterson, whoever else at the time, you know, writing the TV, you know, all their kind of, Jim Ross obviously sat there brainstorming, and this was 94, 95, Jim Cornette got a bit more kind of influence.
Well, what's quite interesting is that handing of the torch between Heenan and Cornette, I don't think it was just an on-screen thing, because my understanding is that Bobby Heenan was actually in that inner circle as well. He was often more involved with the backstage stuff than you might realise. I think he was quite a major power player behind the scenes, Bobby Heenan, for basically the entirety of his run. I just think they told a story that they took Bobby Heenan with them. This was Bruce Pritchard the other day, said that they took Bobby Heenan with them to go and negotiate the deal with Dusty, for example. And as we'll talk about in maybe later on in the show, he was quite involved with decisions for Coliseum Home Video and things. So it's just interesting that, you know, Cornette essentially takes Heenan's place, not just kind of on TV, but also behind the scenes as well.
No, so that is a good point, obviously, that, you know, he got more and more power in the company. Obviously, he was never, you know, had Vince's ear completely, but he accomplished something, to be fair, that Jerry Lawler never did. And he got Smoky Mountain Wrestling, got mentioned on WWF TV before USWA never got mentioned before that. So I bet might have annoyed Jerry Lawler a bit, I don't know. But obviously Vince already had a deal with USWA, he did some shots down there himself. I mean, you can check out Vince's run, which is fascinating, on YouTube. If you search for McMemphis, the full kind of run there of Vince being a heel, the kind of precursor to the Mr. McMahon character. So I think that's quite an important thing. I don't know why USWA was never mentioned, but then Smoky Mountain was, you know, played off as two kind of independent groups. So it was quite an interesting that.
Well, I mean, we'll probably return to that USWA story on a later show, Alan, because I think it probably deserves, you know, full treatment from us. But how long did this association last with the SMW? Because Cornette was there for all of that time, but were they still doing SMW-related things on TV, you know, after 93?
Not really. I mean, the Heavenly Bodies, they kind of signed full-time to the WWF. I mean, they lost a Loser Leaves Town match in Smoky Mountain, so they gave them the choice, you know, the excuse that then, you know, to work WWF. And they worked WWF, for, you know, through 94, and they went back to Smoky Mountain in 95. But the kind of mention of Smoky Mountain on wrestling died off at the end of 93, really, because the Rock and Roll Express had a match with the Heavenly Bodies at the Survivor Series, if you remember.
I remember that, yes. And what was that for, that match? Was it like for the Smoky Mountain titles?
Yes, it was. It was for the tag team titles.
It's hard to explain to some fans now, but that couldn't have seemed more too Bob to me at the time. Like, I was just... I don't want to say I was appalled as a little 10-year-old or whatever I was, but I did kind of, you know, it would be the moment on the videotape that I would probably go and do something else, which isn't really fair, because I wasn't, you know, but I guess at that time I wouldn't have recognized the Rock and Roll Express as being anything, because of course I didn't really watch the NWA stuff until years later.
No, I think I was about the same. I mean, I'd seen some WCW home video, so I'd seen Ricky Morton in the the York Foundation
right,
run.
Yes.
I'd seen him then, so I was aware of him, and I was aware of them as a tag team. But yeah, I mean, I can see where you're coming from. It looked a bit rinky-dink, third rate, but they had good matches. I'm not saying they got over, but the Heavenly Bodies got a job out of it from WWF, so they'd obviously done something right themselves.
Did you see them as contenders for the main tag titles?
Well, the match that they had, I mean, they had the match with the Steiners at SummerSlam, and I think that was a great match. So, yes and no. I mean, like I said before, the landscape changed. We didn't have as much emphasis on body guys. I know we just mentioned the Steiners, but we had people like the Head Shrinkers who weren't exactly muscle men, and, you know, teams like that. I mean, they were big guys still, don't get me wrong.
I mean, I think the product changed quite a bit between 93 and 94 and 95, though. Where I could see the Heavenly Bodies challenging people like the Smoking Guns, for example, or I could see them feeding with the Quebecers, or I could see them beating, I don't know, or at least having competitive matches with, who were some of the other tag teams around that time?
IRS was tagging with someone else in a $1 million corporation at the time.
IRS and whoever it was. Was it Karma?
Yeah, it could be Karma or someone like that. I mean, there's plenty of teams that they could have worked with because they're smaller guys, like 1-2-3 Kid and Marty Jannetty.
But when it's
like that.
When the scene is like the Head Shrinkers or the Head Shrinkers, the Steiner Brothers, you know, I think Money Inc. had gone by that time. But, you know what I'm saying? It's like you wouldn't buy them against some of those. Like, to me, I tell you what they felt like. They felt similar to the Beverly Brothers.
That's fair.
Yeah. All right. Well, anything else about the Smoky Mountain, or should we move on?
Oh, we'll move on. I mean, it's an interesting topic, and we could cover kind of more mentions of non-WWF stuff on TV. I mean, now, the drop names left, right, and center. But then it was a big deal, and there's more examples of this.
Yeah, well, I tell you, that I remember, because they really didn't mention, they wouldn't acknowledge at all the existence of WCW, and WCW kind of returned the favor as well, because I remember when Big Boss Man turned up in WCW, and he was like, I don't know, the Guardian Angel or the Boss or some nonsense, and it's like they wouldn't mention it. They wouldn't mention any of his past, even though it was clearly Boss Man.
Yeah, which kind of treats the audience like the stupid a little bit. But it is a double-edged sword. You don't want to acknowledge someone's past because, in a way, it's not your creation. It's not your storyline. You didn't have control of what happened to that person. And, you know, the Big Boss Man at the end of his run in WWF kind of petered out a bit, and they brought him back in as a big deal in WCW. So you don't really want to acknowledge that kind of downward slide that he had.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, why don't we go to the next... let's go back to the sack, Alan.
Okay. Back into the sack. Right, we've got one here. Dear Alan and Parv, my favourite wrestler is Jumping Jim Brunzel of the Killer Bees fame. Can you go into what happened to him after the tag team split? And that's from Chadley Crisolo in Norwich, Connecticut. So is this the third or fourth favourite wrestler that Chadley's mentioned to us now on the show?
Well, I don't know. Maybe they're getting better, arguably. You could say that Jim Brunzel wasn't a bad worker in his day.
No, he was a level up from Dino Bravo. I'll give him that. So... Jim Brunzel, interesting guy. What was he doing after his tag team split first? He was a part of the Killer Bees with Brian Blair. What kind of happened with those guys?
I was looking into this, and they were pretty much solidly a tag team all the way through 1987. Do you have any, first of all, do you have any memories of the Killer Bees, Alan? To me... Again, the Killer Bees felt like one of those lower teams, a bit like the Beverly Brothers, or they never felt like a main true contenders for the titles to me.
No, I mean, they were featured a lot in 86. I mean, they did. I don't know if you remember, they had the gimmick where they wore masks for a while, and
yes.
They do the kind of tag team switcheroo. And I also remember they had the yellow and black, they had like socks that they pulled up, these yellow and black socks, and it kind of stood out to me. And they were on WrestleMania 3, which was the first WWF home video that I got. So I do remember them from that time. They never stood out apart from just a generic team that jumped around a lot. Springs in the legs, like I mentioned in the past, these kind of generic teams. So they weren't bad, they weren't great. I mean, they'd been around for a few years by this point anyway. I know that they had an association with the AWA as well.
So basically, they keep on going into 1988. For example, they were doing things like putting over Demolition on Wrestling Challenge. They had a losing effort against the Islanders on Saturday night's main event. They did get a victory at the Spectrum, though, in Philadelphia against the Bolsheviks. They also got a DQ win over the Hart Foundation as late as May, 31st of May 1988. They got a victory over the Hart Foundation on primetime. I'd imagine there was some sort of angle there for the DQ, but does that surprise you that they were still, you know, that they weren't just jobbing clean to Hart Foundation in 1988?
Well, as I said, it would have been for storyline reasons, I'm pretty sure. I mean, this was literally the second to last date that they were a team. I think the day after, they were on the loss to the Fabulous Rousseaus on Superstars.
Right, and that was their last ever. Yes, that's their last ever team-up. And then I guess they go off-screen for a while because there's a gap in Brunzell's kind of match results. He's not on TV again until September. B. Brian Blair, I'll just quickly touch on him because I think there's some interesting little things about Blair.
Such as his tongue was too big for his mouth.
Well, there's that. There's the fact that he was made humble, of course, famously. but also, he disappears from TV as well and comes back around the same time. So when the Killer Bees came back, they were clearly split up and, you know, just plain old Jumping Jim Brunzell and plain old B. Brian Blair. No Killer Bee gimmick.
We're not missing anything here that they were split up for specific reason, i.e. drugs failure or anything like that? Was it just a natural, the tag team had run the end of its course?
I'm not really sure. Maybe somebody could write in and tell us why the Killer Bees stopped tagging together and why they split up. Because Brian Blair goes on and has a series of losses against Mr. Perfect, Dino Bravo, Harley Race. Clearly Harley Race was back from his injury at this point. And he goes on the tour to Italy in Milan. And he has a match against, he tags with Junkyard Dog against Akeem and Harley Race in Rome in Italy. And that was his last appearance for the WWF.
B. Brian Blair, he was very good friends, I think, with Hogan and those kind of guys. And I don't know, obviously he wasn't that friendly because he's lasted till 1988 in the WWF. But to me, he was a guy. Nothing more to me. I mean,
just a lower mid-card wrestler, bland, kind of like, it reminds me a little bit of Mike Graham.
No, I can see that completely.
But he went on to work for Herb Abrams UWF, and he had several tours with New Japan Wrestling, Alan, which I didn't know until today. It kind of surprised me that he was working as late as 2001 for New Japan.
I know that was wild when we discovered this. I mean, in 2001, he did three dates, and when it was him and Steve Kern tagging... On one of the dates, and then the second one was the one that piqued your interest, Parv, wasn't it? The second date he did on the tour.
Kenji Muto and Samu Nishimura defeat B. Brian Blair and Dory Funk Jr. in 18 minutes on TV in 2001 for New Japan. Now, the reason that really perked my interest is that Dory Funk Jr. was one of the original All Japan loyalists. I mean, he wasn't just a worker for All Japan. He was basically the guy who booked the American wrestlers for Giant Barber. So to see him on a New Japan card is very surprising to me. And I didn't know that he'd ever worked for them, let alone tag with Brian Blair.
Well, we're going to have to track down that match, I think.
I may review that this evening. And then the third match that Brian Blair had piqued your interest, didn't it, Alan?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a fan of El Samurai. He's not really spoken about much as nowadays, but in the 90s, I thought he was one of the top juniors in the world. He had some fantastic matches. So Brian Blair versus El Samurai in New Japan in 2001 is just a completely random match. It's one of those matches that I like. It's just completely random on a random promotion. You don't expect it, and it will probably be average as hell, but I'm still going to probably enjoy it just for the fact it's in 2001. It's two completely random guys.
Are you surprised that El Samurai is losing that match to a very old Brian Blair there?
Well, I think so. I mean, I don't know if there's a specific reason for that. I mean, it's a clean loss, so I'm not saying there's a run-in or anything, but is El Samurai pissed someone off? Is he getting punished? You don't know, but it's quite interesting looking back that obviously Brian Blair had the run in 2001 in New Japan. So, I mean, getting back to Jim Brunzell.
Okay. So basically, Jim Brunzell at the same time, back to 1988 now, after the Killer Bees stopped hanging together, on some of these exact same shows where Blair is, you know, doing a job to, say, Dino Bravo, Jim Brunzell is doing a job to Mr. Perfect, or King Haku, or tagging with Lanny Poffo in a losing effort against the Brainbusters. In 3 minutes and 42 seconds. He did make it to the Survivor Series that year, where he tagged with Brutus Beefcake, Sam Houston, the Blue Blazer, and the Ultimate Warrior. What do you make of that Survivor Series team?
Oh, just random teams, bodies on the card at this stage, you know, with some of the teams. I mean, this would have been the 88 one, so they would have had the 10 teams, so 20-man kind of elimination match. So there's 20 guys there, and then they probably had another four matches that had five guys on each team, so there's another, you know, there's a lot, there's 50, 60 guys getting used on the show. 40 at least. I mean, there's a lot of guys getting used, so, I mean, they just needed bodies at this point, so I wouldn't read anything more into it than that.
Yes, and then in 1989, he only has two matches for the WWF total. He works a number of different tours for All Japan that year.
Yeah, he does. I can see, looking through the listings here, he worked a tour throughout July, where he was mainly teaming with Tom Zenk.
Yes.
A total white meat, babyface, tag team, no doubt.
Yes, and I can't really remember seeing many of these matches. Any of them of interest to you?
Not particularly for me.
The only one that's jumping out for me, just out of interest, would be the Kawada match versus Brunzell. There was a second match in on the tour, or the second match that Brunzell worked. It doesn't say how long the match went for, but it may be, you know, slightly fun. I'll see if Kawada could have, you know, carried him to it. Saying that, Kawada in 89, he was good. He wasn't the Kawada that we were getting used to, say, 91, 92 and onwards.
Yes, and I can see also that he had a number of different house show appearances, working against Lord Stephen Regal that wouldn't be Lord Stephen Regal, that would be the other Stephen Regal, clearly Mr. Electricity.
Who was he working for here? Was this in UWF?
Well, this is for WCPW.
Oh, Windy City.
Windy City, yeah.
That's Windy City. So that would have been the Mr. Electricity, Steve Regal, because if you can see, Windy City was out of Illinois, and it's AWA country, and yeah. So those matches would have been dull as dishwater, because Mr. Electricity, Steve Regal was the shits. So yeah, Jim Brunzell, though, he bounced around in the WWF up until 93.
Yes.
And even as late as, he was on Raw, wasn't he?
Yeah, so I mean, just to really quickly tell the story, this is kind of pattern continues where he does a couple of little tours for All Japan, and then he does like random appearances for the WWF. And what I think, Alan, is that they're all kind of one shots. He's not a contracted worker. He's just coming in doing a job for one night. You know, like he'll crop up at MSG against the Berserker or against the Warlord, or, you know, tagging with Dave Siegfrieds against Money Incorporated.
He's obviously a trusted hand. I mean, people that are brought back time after time, they're trustworthy, they can do a good job and they don't hurt people.
Yes. Yes, and he does make it all the way to 1993. And this is what we've included on our playlist this week. His final match in the promotion is on Monday Night Raw, and it's against Damian Demento. I think we both watched this match. What did you make of it?
Well, the match, he got his own entrance and he got his own theme music, which I found really interesting that they'd actually do that for him in 93. So Demento was the first guy in the ring. So he came down, the match lasted 5 minutes, and I think 4 minutes and 49 seconds, 59 seconds of that match, there was no mention of the match at all by the commentary team.
No, they were completely focusing on other things, weren't they?
They were focusing on Rob Bartlett phoning in that he'd lost all his money on the tables in Vegas.
Yes, there seemed to be some sort of deal that he'd gone to Las Vegas, and yes, it was all to do with Rob Bartlett's adventures. Well, one thing that I noticed about Jim Brunzel here is that he was wearing leopard skin tights.
Yeah, no, he was wearing them. I don't know why.
So there was kind of like a hint of Killer Bees colours, but it wasn't quite Killer Bees.
No, I mean, you could tell that on that show, but you wouldn't have told what been able to tell what colour tights he wore when he had his one match in WCW.
Oh.
Do you know why that would be? Because we touched on this on a previous episode.
Okay, why didn't you elucidate?
Well, we had, this was the Legends Reunion, Slamboree 93, where we had Blackjack Mulligan, Jim Brunzel, and Wahoo McDaniel. Don't know why those three were banded together. Versus Dick Murdoch, Don Morocco and Jimmy Snuka. And that was a match that went to a no contest. And they were one of the matches that was...
Spot the odd one out.
Yeah. Just a random kind of... There may be a reason for it on commentary. Am I thinking Mulligan, Brunzel, Wahoo, AWA? No?
It doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work. Because Wahoo didn't really ever run there. No, I have no idea. But they put six of the guys together and they probably had an average match on an average pay-per-view. So that was kind of his last major show that he did in wrestling, really, because after that he did a couple of spots in 94 for one match for Herb Abrams, and then after that he just did one match in 98 for an indie promotion, so that was him done. So he went out, you know, on top, so to speak, in major promotions, I guess. But yeah, Jim Brunzel, a guy that lingered forever, total jobber to the stars.
Yeah, it's kind of the speed of the decline is quite fast, I would say, because, you know, even as early as 89, he is tagging with complete job guys. You know, given the Ronnie Garvin treatment, if you want to put it that way, where, you know, it's him plus, I don't know, Gary Jackson or, you know, pick Bobby Knight or any of these sorts of figures, you know, Jimmy James.
Yeah, it's Dwayne Gills of this world and people like that. No, it was a decline, but it is interesting. We like to talk about the guys that stuck around and that they're still on TV 5 years after the actual initial kind of push.
Now, what interests me slightly here before we move on, Alan, is just how Brian Blair seemed to have a longer career than Brunzel. You wouldn't have expected that, really, in terms of the afterlife. You know, he was still getting bookings in 2001, whereas it seems like Brunzel had completely finished.
Fallen off the face of the earth, yeah. You know, you don't know what else has gone on, his injuries. I mean, Brunzel did have a 26-year career. I mean, he debuted in 72.
Yeah, he started very early, didn't he?
Yeah. So, I mean, he had a long, long career. I mean, he was trained with the AWA guys by Vern Gagne and Billy Robinson. So he'd been there, been around the block. I think maybe his body was hurting and he'd, you know, had enough.
All right, great. Well, I hope that answered your question. It's probably the most anybody's talked about Jim Brunzel for a while. Or at least that portion of his career.
Well, that's what we're here for. That's the service we're providing to the listeners. We're talking about these kind of weird little nuggets of information that we come across that people might not be aware of.
Yes. Okay. Well, do we have time for one more? Maybe a quick one.
I think we could squeeze one in. We've got a letter here from Charles Lossing from Little Rock in Arkansas, and Charles says, I swear I remember seeing Hercules jump right up after taking a powerbomb from Sid Justice. So it's not really a question as such, he's just making a statement there. So Charles, thank you very much for your statement there. And yeah, so there was a match that occurred in 1992. It was Hercules' last match for the promotion. It's a match that you've seen recently, Parv. So do you want to describe it to the listeners, what actually happened?
Well, basically, it's a rather fast match, a squash, I think we'd call it. And Sid pins Hercules, and after giving him a power... Did he give him a power bomb?
Yeah, he finishes him off, kick to the gut, power bomb, and that's how he beats him.
And then Hercules almost immediately just stands up and walks out of the ring. Now, I remember, Alan, I don't know about you, that this was a match that kind of did the rounds in the early days of the internet. I seem to remember being alerted to this match fairly early on.
Yeah, no, it was something I saw quite early on as well. I mean, for me, the match stands out for quite a few reasons. Right from the outset, his appearance, I mean, he's greying his beard. I mean, there's a clip, like there's a smaller clip and a longer clip of the full match. So the longer clip, you can notice his hair's frizzy, his beard is grey, and he's kind of looks like he's let himself go by 1992 WWF standards. So that screams to me a guy who doesn't give a shit and he's on his way out.
Yeah, well, I mean, was that his last match?
Yeah, that was his last match for WWF. I mean, after that, he showed up later in the year in WCW Super Invader, and it was quite obvious that it was Hercules, even for me as a young fan.
I can say he wasn't very good in that.
No, he wasn't good at all. But the one thing you may not have noticed when on the clip that you saw, he came out to his old face music. And that was the first time he'd ever done that since he turned heel after joining up with Slick and Roma, maybe even before that. So Hercules coming out in 1992 to his kind of original kind of face music before that heel turn.
Now, while we're on this subject, what was Hercules doing kind of prior to this? Do you have any idea? I'm just having a...
Oh, no, you're probably on a mental block. He was in Power and Glory with Paul Roma. What basically happened...
When did Power and Glory finish?
Well, it was quite recently. It was, before that. It was in the fall of 91. So I think what happened was Hercules didn't really fall into the WWF's plans anymore. And then with the steroid scandal in full force, he was kind of one of the mainstays of a previous generation that was cleared out. This time is really interesting, I feel, because you had guys, all these guys all emptied around January to April, May of 92. You had Hercules, Haku, Barbarian, Kerry Von Erich, Nikolai Volkoff, Greg Valentine, Colonel Mustafa, General Adnan, Marty Jannetty, Roddy Piper, Jimmy Snuka, Jake Roberts, Warlord, Sid Justice, Sergeant Slaughter, Hulk Hogan and the Mountie. They were all gone. You know, for various different reasons, but that's a huge kind of lot of, the roster there going within like 3 or 4 months spell.
Yes, there's a lot of them, isn't there? And I feel like even a little bit after that, whoever survives that clear out, is gone by, I want to say like SummerSlam 93 would be a time that seems to be like the last event where you get a lot of 80s guys on the cards.
Yeah, I think times were changing, and that was reflected on the shows, especially with steroid scandals and things like that still looming over, and into 94 when Vince went against the government and actually ultimately won. But yeah, the landscape was changing, bodies were changing, so you guys like Hercules, Barbarian and Warlord just simply didn't have a place anymore.
Now, in 1992, Hercules was still getting quite a few victories over Jim Brunzel, I should note. To tie our last two questions together. Just before we move on from this, I don't know how many reasons we'll have to return to Hercules in future shows, but any views on Herc in general? I mean, was he completely... I know I've seen some fans don't have the highest opinion of him. Do you think that he did anything of value during his WWF run?
Well, he was there. He was a roided up guy on the card. He was never awesome. I did enjoy his run with Roma as Power and Glory. They did have some nice matches there.
They had a very cool finisher, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, the Powerplex. It was the superplex followed by a big splash, wasn't it? And I thought that was an awesome move at the time. Good timing on that move.
Always looked so cool, that move.
So I think that gave Hercules a little bit of extra kind of oomph. They looked to me like they were not a makeshift team, but I think they did better than what originally was kind of designed for them.
Right,
I mean, what do you think about that? I mean, from your point of view, is...
Well, I mean, in my mind, they were a cool team around that time.
I like the glasses that they wore, the sunglasses. Do you remember them?
Yeah, no, they were, in fact, we were talking about the Killer Bees. I'd see them as maybe being a tiny smidge up from the Killer Bees, just because they seem more credible to me.
Oh, no, definitely. I mean, I would have them above the Killer Bees there as well. So then after this, Hercules, so just getting back to the match itself. So Sid powerbombs him. Hercules as well, if you notice, he puts his hands up behind his head to protect himself from the powerbomb, which is good psychology in a way, but no one ever does that. But if you know you're going up for a move and you can protect your head, why wouldn't you protect your head to minimise the impact? So some people are saying, oh, he's shit, you know, this, that and the other, but you can look at it a different way. He's the bestseller of a powerbomb I've ever... Not the bestseller, but going up for the powerbomb, it made the most sense. So well done, Hercules.
Hercules is another guy who ended up going to work for New Japan.
He did. He had a good run in New Japan as the Jurassic Powers with Scott Flash and Orton, and they made quite an imposing team, and they won the tag straps at least once, or maybe more.
So it's just interesting. I mean, he's somebody who feels like he should be completely done after that, but he has another few years on his career.
Yeah, and he gets out of US wrestling, I think was a wise move for someone with his body type.
Yeah. All right, well, I think that probably... I don't know if we even had a question from Charles there, but, you know, that was Hercules. And an interesting take, Alan, because that has been one of those... It was always seen as evidence that Hercules couldn't sell or wouldn't sell or was just unprofessional or something. So interesting to get an alternative take on it. So now we'll go over to JT Rosero for the Event Center.
Let's take you down to the Event Center.
Thank you, Parvin Allen. JT Rosero here in the Letters from Kayfabe Event Center. Coming at you this week in early October, I want to take you all the way back to 1993. A very interesting episode of Raw happened on 10-4. We saw a battle royal occur to determine who would go on to fight to become the new WWF Intercontinental Champion. Of course, the title had been vacated by Shawn Michaels the week before when Jack Tunney actually stripped him of it due to not fulfilling his contractual obligations. Of course, behind the scenes, Shawn was battling with the company over a failed drug test that he believed he did not legitimately fail. He thought it was something screwy going on. They thought he was high as a kite. Both were probably true. So they took the belt off him, put it up for grabs in a battle royal. It wasn't the usual battle royal scenario, though. Here, the final two men left in the ring would fight the next week to determine who would be the champion. Interesting crew that was involved, including one guy here that always caught my eye, and that was MVP, the future Abe Knuckleball Schwartz. It was his debut in this match. Didn't really pump him up too much. He had appeared in the crowd for a few weeks. Of course, this was around the time of the baseball strike in 1994. It occurred back in August, so he had been on TV here and there. Didn't really know he was going to become an in-ring character, but he did. It was Steve Lombardi with a baseball drawn on his face with paint and kind of just a baseball uniform, I guess. And he doesn't really have much of anything going on here in this match. He would stick around as a jobber to the stars as Abe Knuckleball Schwartz following, but it's always funny that he was in such a big match in Raw history. Also notable for being a post-SummerSlam Giant Gonzalez match, where I guess he's a de facto face. He had kind of turned on Harvey Whippleman, and everyone gangs up on him right away, and they all throw him out 30 seconds into the match. So kind of a curiosity there, too, his final Raw appearance and one of his final appearances in general in the World Wrestling Federation. The match would come down to Razor Ramon, Rick Martel, and the Quebecers. And it was interesting as well because Rick Martel had just returned to the promotion himself the week before along with Jimmy Snuka. They had a match from New Haven, and then they would fight here later in the taping in this match. Snuka would be tossed earlier in the bout, but Rick Martel hung on to the end, and it was him and Razor Ramon that would co-win the match and go on to the next week, which was still part of the same taping, where they tussled over the title, and Razor Ramon completed his face turn officially by defeating Rick Martel 10.5 minutes. Razor won that vacant title with the Razor's Edge. Of course, he had turned face pretty much over the summer, defeated Ted DiBiase at SummerSlam, and this really solidified his standing and showed that he was a star on the rise, and he would go on to hold that title for quite a while, all the way until April of 1994. So, interesting time in Raw history and for the company. Of course, Shawn Michaels will be back by November. That's neither here nor there. What is here is PlaceOfNation.com. Plenty of podcasts and written pieces for your enjoyment. Follow us on iTunes. Subscribe to all of our feeds, PTBN, PWO, Place to Be Podcast, and PTBN Pop. And follow us all across social media. We will be back next week right here with taking a look at Piper's Pit. Of course, if you remember last week, looked at the initial talk show back in the day, Roger's Corner. And now we're talking about its evolutionary son, Piper's Pit, which is, of course, arguably the most famous of all the talk shows in WWF history. Still to come tonight, though, we're looking at the themed tapes from Coliseum Home Video. So check that out. I have a ton of them. I love them all. You can decide which your favorites. I know Parv and Allen will talk about theirs. I'm going to toss it back to the lads. I'm out. I'll talk to you next week. Take care.
Well, welcome back, and thank you very much for that, Justin. Fascinating as ever.
Well, Justin, you need to pass on a message to him. My check bounced this week, Justin, working for you guys. You brought me on, I'm doing a great job, and you know my check bounces. You guys, come on. Come on now.
The Place to Be Nation.
I'm coming after you, Place to Be Nation. I'm going to get to that Place to Be Nation headquarters, and I'm going to be knocking on that door.
Well, they're based in Connecticut, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. So, yeah, I'll go there first, and I'll see if I can pop into Titan Towers afterwards.
No, I think it's time for a longer topic. Do we have any letters that fit that bill this week, Alan?
We've got a doozy, actually. Works out nicely. Dear Alan and Parv, you guys talk about Sean Mooney a lot. We do. And for good reason, and there'll be more Sean Mooney to come, I'm sure, in the future. So, do you remember the special theme Coliseum Home Videos like the Super Tapes? And that's from Matt in Portland, Oregon. And we do remember them quite well, don't we, Parv?
Well, yes. And I was a big tape collector myself, of course. I recently, tragically, sold all of my tapes, the entire collection, for a measly £26. Which is something that I don't want to talk about, Alan.
Well, that's shocking, really. I mean, if you'd said that to yourself 10 years earlier, you'd have probably slapped yourself.
Well, I mean, it cost me many, many more times than £26 to build a collection.
Well, so. Each video in the UK was around £14.99, wasn't it?
Yeah, typically I think it'd be £14.99, and some of the tapes I paid considerably more than that for because we couldn't get them in this country. Which I'll get on to. Now, what do you know about Coliseum Home Video, Alan, and its history?
Well, I was always under the impression that Coliseum Home Video wasn't owned by the WWF. They were a third-party distributor that acted on behalf of WWF, and they released tapes. Are we going back to 1985, would you say, when the first releases came out?
I think the first tape was in 1984. And it was Bloopers, Bleeps, and Body Slams. That's the very first tape. And then the next one, which I believe was a tape that sold, you know, in huge quantities, was the Hulkamania tape. That was the second release, and that came out in 1985, followed by the Best of WWF Volume 1, which, again, I think was an 85 release or late 84. Those were the first three that came out under the Coliseum banner. I mean, it's quite interesting, the connection between the WWF and Coliseum Home Video, because, yeah, I was always kind of aware that these guys were independent. But you'd imagine that Vince and the WWF would be quite involved in the making of these tapes, wouldn't you, in the match selection, in the presentational elements, in the filming. You'd think it would all just be done by Vince and his company, and then they would send that off to the video company, who would then just distribute it. Is that how you'd imagine it would work? That's how I imagined it would work.
Well, yeah, I would say so on the whole, because there's so much stuff that is just complete Vinceisms throughout a lot of these tapes. I mean, later on with the tapes, we start getting skits with wrestlers and skits with announcers and, you know, all sorts of kind of wacky tomfoolery. The earlier stuff, it's kind of best of tapes and introducing guys. And I think it's very important to kind of this underpins the whole expansion thing for me. I mean, from 1984, they're in home video, and they were selling in places where WWF wasn't strong point. So they're selling these tapes, you know, mail order and in stores as well, I believe. So they were selling them in places where WWF weren't stronghold. So having tapes in video stores to rent and to buy really kind of helped for when WWF came to town with house shows, I feel.
Yeah, well, it was absolutely instrumental for getting over with all of the little kids. I mean, even in my fandom, Alan, you know, when you're, I think people forget about this, when you're 7, 8, 9 years old, you just watch the same tape again and again and again.
Oh, you burn it out, you watch it that many times.
And I certainly had tapes like that. And I think that if it wasn't for the videos, I wouldn't be the fan I am today. I mean, especially in this country, we really relied on those tapes sometimes because it was quite difficult to watch the pay-per-views at times. We didn't even, you know, I think they did show them on Sky, didn't they? But it was late at night.
What they did in the UK, with they showed them on delay on Sky Movies, which was a premium channel, a subscription channel here in the UK. But they weren't done in a timely manner. But then would it really matter at that point? Because this was pre-internet, this was pre-anything. And they came out basically, more importantly, before the magazines did. So PWI was always dated as hell when it came out in the UK. Even in the US, really, there's always people quip about that. But we still got the pay-per-views if you had Sky. And that's a big thing. You could only get the pay-per-views in this country if you had Sky. So if you didn't have Sky, which was the majority of the population at that point, you were waiting for the releases on video. So a lot of the time, you weren't seeing stuff till, you know, 9 months, a year after the actual event occurred.
Yeah, waiting and waiting for those tapes to come out. I certainly remember it. So just going back to the history of Coliseum Home Video briefly, there was a chap called Stephen Hetch, who was a producer who worked for Coliseum Video. And he was basically in charge of selecting the footage for the tapes and editing them together, and also producing the segments with whatever talent the WWF would send. In the earlier days, it would be mostly Gene Okerlund or sometimes Vince himself. I think Vince tended to take the best of the WWF tapes. Whereas Gene tended to host some of the others. And they basically have three lines, Alan, three themed tapes, if you want to put it this way. So, and in fact, those first three releases are quite a good kind of rule, because they had the kind of gimmick tapes, the novelty tapes. So that is, and I'll just mention some of these, because some of our listeners probably had some of these tapes as kids. Wrestling Bloopers, Bleeps, and Body Slams. WF's Most Unusual Matches. The Biggest, the Smallest, the Strongest. The Amazing Managers. The Tag Team Champions. Grudge Matches. Villains of the Squared Circle. Inside the Steel Cage. Grand Slams. The History of the Intercontinental Belt. Even More Unusual Matches. These are some of the kind of the novelty theme tapes that they had in those kind of, this would be, you know, from about 85 to 89, 90. Did you have any of those tapes, Alan? Have you seen any of them?
I've seen some of them. I mean, I was quite lucky that this would have been in the mid-90s. A friend of mine knew someone in the area that I live that imported some of the tapes, so these were the best of WWF ones. So I had never seen, like a lot of people, WWF pre-1985. So on some of these tapes, the best of WWF and the Unusual Matches, they were showing stuff, you know, earlier on in history. So you were seeing, it's still always the 80s really, but you were seeing kind of Andre in a cage versus Kamala when he's slamming him, and all this stuff where the presentation looked completely different, which we've touched on in previous episode. But it kind of opened my eyes up to some things. I was like, wow. And I borrowed these tapes and I watched them and watched them and watched them and watched them, because it was so limited kind of footage from that era that you could see at that time. And they were really interesting to me anyway.
Yeah, no, I mean, some of them, I know my friend Kelly, who co-presents one of the other shows I do here called Titans of Wrestling. I know those history of the Intercontinental Belt and the history of the Tag Team Belts were really like formative for his interest in wrestling history, because honestly, on the main WWF TV, they so seldom mention anything before Hogan, as we've mentioned before. They very rarely go into, like, you know, the most you might get is a mention of Tito Santana once being Intercontinental Champion or something. That'd be like the most history we ever got. Would you agree?
Yeah, no, there's lots of examples like that. For one that we've discussed was at WrestleMania 3 when Jesse Ventura was commentating on Adrian Adonis Roddy Piper, and I think Gorilla Monsoon mentioned that they were a tag team called the East West Connection, referred to him as his old tag team partner, but they didn't really elaborate on it, and I thought, how were they tag team partners? And, you know, it was never explained. So they did things like that a lot, and they laid breadcrumbs, but not enough breadcrumbs to kind of connect the dots, so to speak.
Yeah, so some of these tapes would literally be the only place you'd ever see, you know, a Bruno San Martino match, for example, or anything along those lines. You know, Mr. Fuji as an actual wrestler would be something I'd point to. Yes. So the other thing that we should mention is that we didn't get any of these tapes in the United Kingdom. These early tapes that I'm telling you about now. So all of those ones that I just mentioned never got a UK release. So, you know, Alan was saying he was lucky to see them because they didn't come out in the PAL format, only in the US style format. So there was those kind of themed tapes, the novelty tapes. Then alongside they had the personality tapes, or, you know, basically videos based around one specific worker. And do you think it's interesting to see who they featured on these tapes?
Well, I think they were the stars of the time, but the one I've never watched and the one I really want to watch, because see how much kayfabe they put into it, is the Kempatera story. That'd be an interesting if that was they told the real Ken Patera story, but I presume they would touch on him going into prison.
Yeah.
Maybe not. In fact, no. This would have been before then. I think. Do you think this was before he came back in '88 and he looked like a granny with permed hair?
This was for his 1987 babyface push.
Oh, so this was around then. So it was
as Justin has called on Place to Be, you know, pasty legs Ken Patera, where basically he'd gone to jail, and now he'd come back and he'd set himself on the straight and narrow. And I can't remember if I've actually seen this video or not. I want to say that I've seen bits of it, but I've never actually sat down and watched it all, because Ken Patera was never one of my favorites. I think it basically shows him, like, early on. Like, I can see here they've got his Intercontinental title win against Pat Patterson, and a couple of early appearances. And then they basically just... There's a section called Ken Patera Biography, where I'm guessing that's where I'd imagine they'd show, you know, some newspaper clippings about him going to
prison. With solemn music and...
Maybe a heart-to-heart. I don't know, because it's been a while since I even contemplated this tape. And then basically they just show quite a lot of his matches from the 87 run.
Well, that face run in 87, just quickly, I always, obviously I didn't watch it at the time, but when I watched it years later, I thought, what a loser. What an absolute loser. I'm not going to root for you, Ken Patera, with your stupid permed hair and your tights. You don't interest me. You don't look like a strong man. Where's your biceps? Everyone else on this roster looks better than you. Go away. So, yeah, Ken Patera in that face run, it really wasn't for me.
He feels completely out of place.
Yeah.
Does he make the Survivor Series that year?
Yeah, the 87 Survivor Series. He's on Hogan's team. It just doesn't fit in at all. I don't know if Vince took pity on him. He had, you know, mortgages to pay and things, and Vince brought him back in, because, don't get me wrong, he had a great career in the WWF before this. Now we can look back at things and we can see that Ken Patera was, you know, he's a Hall of Famer. You know, I mean, there's certain people will agree with me with that one, that he's a legitimate Hall of Famer. We're not burying him. I just think this run at the time, you know, it wasn't his finest moment.
Yeah, and much like we talked about with Buddy Rose a few weeks ago, I think a lot of people's only exposure to Kenpotaro would be this run, unfortunately.
So
he was a much better wrestler earlier on in his career, especially as we've documented on Titans of Wrestling. You know, his 1980 is probably one of the best years that anybody would have with the WWF. Some of the other people, it was Hulk, Andre the Giant, Roddy Piper, who else got Ricky the Dragon Steamboat got a tape?
The Life and Times of Lou Albano.
The Life of Times of Captain Lou, which I'm sure would be entertaining. Captain Lou is usually good value. But basically that's a lot of the Cyndi Lauper stuff on that tape. There's a little bit of his early career, but mostly it's, Cyndi Lauper angle stuff, which is brilliant. Have you ever sat down and watched that stuff?
Some of the stuff I've watched, and then it parlayed into him being in the Cyndi Lauper video after that as well, into the music video for, Just Wanna Have Fun.
It's really funny because, but basically, you know, he makes a little cameo in that video.
He's the dad, isn't he?
Yeah, he's the dad in the video. And he leverages that to claim he is entirely responsible for Cyndi Lauper's career, that he's the one who made her a star. He basically just tries to claim, 100% credit. You were a tramp. You were nothing before me.
Well, I'll tell you what. I do, just to jump in there, Parv. Here's a theory for you. If it wasn't for Lou Albano, WWF wouldn't exist anymore.
No, why do you say that?
Well, how did WrestleMania come about? Have you ever heard of, is it David Wolfe?
Yes. He is featured in that angle. He makes many appearances on TNT.
Well, David Wolfe was the kind of music executive, wasn't he? And he randomly, as the story I've been told anyway, that he just started chatting on a flight with Lou Albano, and he thought Lou Albano was this fantastic character. And one thing led to another. Lou introduced him to Vince, they struck a deal, and, the ball started rolling with the rock and wrestle thing.
Yeah, and that's when they had the big card. Was it the War to Settle the Score?
Yeah, and then, from there we had the expansion. Well, the expansion was already ongoing, but that was, the next step was to get mainstream popularity, on TV, and that's what they got through MTV. So, that's kind of all thanks to Lou Albano in a certain way. So thank you, Captain Lou.
So other people who got a tape, the Hart Foundation, which is a little bit surprising because... it's mainly the Hart Foundation as heels, which surprised me that a heel team would get a video.
Maybe it sold well in Canada.
Oh, that's a good point. Very good point, Alan. Who else got a tape? Jake Roberts got a tape. Georgie Animal Steel got a tape. Ugh. Brutus Beefcake got a tape.
Yeah.
Here's one of my absolute favorite tapes ever. It's the Macho Madness tape from 1988, which is an absolutely brilliant... I mean, talk about hidden gems. This is the other thing we'll say, Alan. I think it's fair to say that the wrestling quality is not always brilliant on these tapes. Would you agree?
No, I agree. I mean, they don't go for match quality. I don't know really what they go for. There's just a presentation of the stars, really.
Well, I mean, that Steve chap who I mentioned, Stephen Hetch, he actually claims to have watched more wrestling than anybody on Earth apart from Vince McMahon.
I don't believe him because I can probably name three people off the top of my head that have seen more wrestling in their life than him. Probably some that are listening to this show, funnily enough. I'm going to call him out on that one, and I'm going to call him a liar. He's a liar.
He claims that he watched hours and hours of footage in the actual WWF vaults. Picking out stuff for all of these different tapes, and he was given a virtual carte blanche to pick what he wanted, and then it was sent to Titan, and Vince gave final approval.
Well, it's got a shit taste in matches, then, if that's the case. My God.
Which is interesting, considering how kind of scattershot the selections tend to be on them. But the Macho Madness tape, I tell you what, Alan, when I sat down and watched that years ago, I was blown away. Because it features many, many different iterations of Randy Savage, which is Ted DiBiase. at a time where you don't tend to see real kind of go work rate type matches, whereas all of them have got a huge amount of energy and great moves and things. and just Savage in general. Even like the match he has with Butch Reed and Greg Valentine on there. So if you're going to track down any tape, the Macho Madness one would be my call. So alongside the ones, you know, the novelty tapes and the personality tapes, you also had the Best of the WWF, which we've said. And that ran, Alan, all the way from volume 1 to volume 20.
Yeah, that took some time then, didn't it?
And that was another set of tapes that we could not get in this country. I remember sending off the various different ones from traders in the late 90s and early 2000s. In the early days of eBay, I would be sending off for these tapes because of little things that I'd read about. And I was like, well, I have to see that. Because I think we struggle to remember a time before YouTube these days.
Now, God, we're spoiled now completely.
Now you can just say, oh, you know, One Man Gang and Akeem and just put it into YouTube. But back then, it was like, oh, I don't believe this happened. I'll only believe it when I see it with my own eyes. And then, like, I, you know, get the tape and, you know, you find out all sorts of things that went on, you know, on the Best of WWF tapes. Again, not chosen for match quality. And also, even in some of the angles they chose are not necessarily the most memorable ones, you know. But they do, I mean, I don't know. They tend to fill them full of things like, you know, the Mr. Perfect skits and things like that, you know?
Yeah, with the bowling and things. But the thing that, I mean, after that, they obviously released pay-per-views as well. And then what happened really after that is we didn't have the ones themed around actual wrestlers as such, but they did go into more things like the show with WrestleFests on tape and world tours and things like that, as well as the pay-per-views. And that's the kind of the way they went into the 90s, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, so around 1990, there's a big change, I feel. Like that, so those three original lines that I've just talked you through, they seem to come to an end. And, like, new lines feel like they start. The WrestleFests start getting released. Super Tape is something that comes about. And more or less replaces the Best of the WWF series. And then you get the world tours, like you mentioned, and then things like Battle of the WWF Superstars and mega matches. And
this is what I want to talk about, this era. So we had all sorts of fun kind of match tapes that appeared around here, didn't we?
Office matches is one that stands out, yeah. And just to explain, Alan, before we get into some of the contents of these, because I feel like some of these are some of the very best tapes, these ones in this little run. Basically, we in the UK started getting all of these from about 1990 onwards. I would say from the first Super Tape onwards, we get absolutely everything here as well.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, and it kind of fell into when, you know, we were becoming bigger and bigger fans. I mean, the UK boom period, you know, in the early 90s, it didn't really end till, you know, back in the 93. That's been discussed on other podcasts that we've been on in the past about things like that. But, yeah, it kind of, we were able to get everything at that point, and things went a little bit weirder on the tapes. Especially like with the question that was asked about Sean Mooney. He was very heavily featured on a lot of these tapes, wasn't he, Parv?
Yes, and I will admit my love of Sean Mooney probably goes back to the Super Tapes, where, I mean, basically they'd have a lot of fun. It would typically be Sean Mooney and Lord Alfred Hayes would be the team on so many of these tapes. And it often feels like the introductions to those tapes happen in their own little mini universe. I mean, it's similar to what we were talking about with Wrestling Spotlight and Ian Mooney a few weeks ago. I feel like the world of the Coliseum tapes of the early 90s are their own little universe, and there'd be ongoing kind of little stories. I seem to remember one where they go to London. Do you remember that one?
I do remember that vaguely. So it wasn't behind a green screen. They actually went to London, didn't they?
They went to, I think, to Sean Mooney and Bobby Heenan. No, Sean Mooney and Lord Al go to London. And Lord Alfred Hayes is, like, disgusted at Sean Mooney's tie. I mean, it sounds, you know, but if they kind of, every time they come back to the, you know, they'll show a match and then they'll be in a different location in London. And Mooney's trying on a different tie and things like this. Or sometimes they'd have different themes in the studio. So, like, you know, it'll be a war theme, and he's sitting in a tank, and his face is painted up, and things like this.
Oh, no, I've got examples of this. So if I can go through, it wasn't just Super Tapes. I mean, Super Tapes were what the question was, but Sean Mooney and others were all over some of these tapes. So I'm just going to go through some of the ones that stood out to me. So we had Wrestling Grudge Matches. I don't know if you remember that tape, Parv.
Yeah, one of my early ones, yeah. I remember that.
Well, Sean Mooney, what's he up to there? He's on his honeymoon and he's caring for his sick wife who's making weird noises in a bed. And the bed is actually the duvet, is a WWF duvet. So, I always thought they only made them for single beds. So, you know, I was a little bit, when I saw that, I thought, wow, I want one of them for my double bed. but yeah, so that was the first one, Wrestling Grudge Matches, when he did that. And another one was with Wacky Things, was Smack 'em Whack 'em. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, no, well, actually, I mean, Smack 'em Whack 'em is notable for being a great tape as well. As well as the Sean Mooney stuff. There's some good stuff on there.
Oh, no, it's got the first ladder match between Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart, I believe.
It's also got the Bret title win over Ric Flair.
No, that's right, it does. So that's a good tape from showing stuff in the back end of 92. But my favourite thing on it... The Bushwhackers spent the entire video with Lord Alfred Hayes attempting to just randomly renovate a house.
I remember that.
let's just renovate a house. Lord Alfred Hayes in his probably 70s with the Bushwhackers, who were probably also in the 70s. but yeah, that was interesting on that one, and all the hijinks they got up to.
I seem to remember as well, Alan, something to do with Yokozuna eating rice on that one as well.
Oh yeah, there was also a feature right there, I was going to get to that, called Cooking with Yokozuna. So this was very early in, very, very early on in his run, because he only really debuted at the back end of 92. So that was Smack 'em Whack 'em. The next one that I really stands out to me is Rampage 92. We had Makeup Tips with Sensational Sherry, where she basically gave what they perceived a plain Jane, and they gave her the Sherry scary Sherry look, and the poor girl left traumatized.
I remember. Yep.
Super Tape 92, which I never understood the skit at the time because I wasn't American, is Tax Tips with IRS.
Oh, one of the all-time classics. Yep.
then we had Mega Matches, was another tape. And like me, my guilty pleasure on Mega Matches was seeing Hillbilly Jim wrestling a dog on a mattress in his kitchen at his house. while Hillbilly Jim's granny made us all feel welcome in their humble abode.
Oh, God. I mean, they're a gold. They really are a gold mine. I was so into this stuff. You know, it's a bit like even at the time I was into it, but then I went through a real spurt about 10 years later, you know, when the nostalgia kicks in. And this was really my wheelhouse, all of these tapes that you're talking about here, Alan.
Oh, you said they were at the level where it's bad, it's good, isn't it, Parv?
Yeah, I mean, really, if you watch this stuff and you don't have some love for Lord Al and Mooney after them, then I don't think you've got a sense of fun, you know.
Because, no, you're dead inside, basically. But there's two more that stand out with Mooney anyway. There's Rampage 92, where Sean Mooney, he presents the tape from the Wild West, and I don't know if you remember this, he randomly just shoots a man dead who was just trying to get Sean Mooney's attention. So Sean just shot him. I think that was a bit of an overreaction from Sean Mooney there. And the other one that stands out was Invasion 92, where Sean Mooney is dressed as a character or ripping off a character from Star Trek, and he's on a really shoddy set that looks like the bridge of Star Trek.
Yes.
And his basically thing is like the WWF is going to continue to explore strange new worlds. So maybe they were going to go and do a show in Wales after that, Parv. I'm not too sure.
And that is that is one of the cheesier ones where he's in the Star Trek stuff.
Costume, yeah. So I mean, the last tape that I'm going to mention on this feature wasn't like a funny thing, or it was just a fantastic match, was the WrestleFest 94 tape, which we had the Steiner Brothers versus Bret and Owen. I don't know if you've ever seen that match.
Oh, that's a great match. Yeah,
yeah, it is, isn't it? That's a gem. That's easily a 4-star match, and that's featured on, you know, WrestleFest 94. So I'm sure it's available online now, and anyone can get hold of it. But at the time, you're getting matches that weren't on TV, and they're only exclusively filmed for Coliseum Home Video, and they're on these type of tapes.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. There's one tape which has virtually the entirety of This Tuesday in Texas on it. In fact, I think it's Super Tape 92, which you just mentioned there.
Yeah, I think you're right. It was Super Tape 92.
That's one of the better tapes, actually, because watching that, there's a quite a lot of like Jake Roberts promos on there and things. And I remember the first time I sat down and watched that, it completely blew my mind. Some of that Randy Savage, Jake Roberts angle.
Yeah, at the time, I mean, that was a hardcore angle for 1991, which they moved into that kind of way for a little while, and I thought it was quite interesting. I mean, other people have touched on this. I mean, I know that on Between the Sheets, the our good buddies Chris and Bix, when they've covered 1991, have kind of touched on that transition to more of a, you know, would you say cutting edge, or would you say more close to the bone? I don't know, but less cartoony anyway.
I think they were really making some daring moves in 1991 in general. And this is probably something we should return to, because I think it's a good topic that we could discuss in its own right.
Yeah, I think we could do a full show on the kind of changes in 91. So we'll pencil that in, or if someone wants to word it as a question, feel free.
Well, great. So, it's been fascinating as ever, Alan. Why don't we tell people how to get in touch one last time?
Okay, like we said at the top of the show, the easiest way to get in touch with me is on Twitter, and that's at Alan_Cheapshot. So that's A-L-L-A-N. And there's a few ways to get hold of you, isn't there, Parv?
Yes, you can get in touch on Twitter. That's at Jerry Von K. Or you can go on Facebook and find the PWOPTBN Facebook group. Get in touch with us on there as well. Any other ways?
Any other way? I think if you go on Pro Wrestling Only, it's a great message board. We've got a lot of association, obviously, here at the Place to Be Nation, being on the PWOPTBN feed. There's a thread started on there where people can kind of chime in, feedback to the show, add questions. That's in the podcast section. So I think that's quite a centralized place people can go to as well, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Great. Well, join us next time for more Letters from Kayfabe.
See you later, guys.
The best of WWF American Wrestling. WrestleMania. SummerSlam. Survivor Series. Royal Rumble. UK Rampage. And many more specialist releases. Available only through Silver Vision, the official distributor of the World Wrestling Federation's videos. So if it's body slam, side suplexes, clotheslines, drop kicks, and power slams that you're after, increase your library of WWF videos with some of these spectacular annual WWF events. Bringing home to you the very best of the World Wrestling Federation's matches.
All WWF wrestling superstars are highly trained professional athletes. Do not imitate or copy their performances or actions. This program is solely intended for your viewing pleasure.
Hello, everybody. This is Sean.